The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Good morning. I am Claudio Grossman, the Dean of the Law School, and on behalf of American University, Washington College of Law, I want to welcome all of you to this exciting conference on how legal rhetoric shapes the law. As we begin, I would like to take this opportunity to thank the organizers of this event for all their hard work and tremendous initiative. Teresa Woodwin-Fels, the director of our legal rhetoric program, and legal rhetoric professors Paul Figley, David Spratt, Jamie Abrams, Jessica Shani-Dosh. To all of them, thank you. In addition to their busy lives here, their commitment with the thinking in the area and the development of the discipline is expressed in initiatives like this one, and as a community, we value this initiative greatly. I would also like to thank our moderator and panelists, as well as our keynote speaker, Professor James Boyd White, for sharing their time and insight with us. We welcome all of you to our home, and we look forward to your comments concerning this very important field. Our school is a fitting place to hold this important event. Our institution has long recognized that legal rhetoric skills are an essential aspect of the practice of law. This commitment is reflected in the importance given to legal rhetoric by our curriculum and programs, as well as the strength and comprehensiveness of our legal rhetoric program. Our two-semester legal rhetoric course is both required and graded, setting us apart from some other law school. Our program faculty-student ratio is 15 students to one, and is among the lowest in the country, permitting individualized attention and intensive student-centered learning techniques. These are important features strengthened by the fact that legal analysis, research, and writing techniques are consciously integrated in other first-year courses, thereby reinforcing our students' development and utilization of these skills. Our legal rhetoric program realistically stimulates the actual work that lawyers do, equipping students with the tool required to resist alarms, for example, and unannounced events, and with the tools required for effective advocacy. The program is much more than that. The presence of faculty teaching the courses who are here is not restricted to that, but also our legal rhetoric faculty participates in the governance of the institution, contributes greatly to the overall academic effort of this law school, contributes to the development of our integrated sections in the first year, and I would say I cannot imagine a law school without their presence. The comprehensive program that we have extends beyond the first year of law school. All students are required to complete an upper level writing requirement by producing a lengthy paper of publishable quality under faculty supervision. We also offer courses in law and narration and appellate advocacy, as well as in legal drafting, that emphasizes preparation of transactional, litigation-related, and other documents. Our writing across the curriculum approach has been implemented in an increasing number of courses and programs, both to enrich the legal education and to develop specialized legal writing skills. However, we are not where we want to be. We're in a process of expansion and learning and knowledge. That's why this type of conference is very important for us. Knowledge, it took 1,800 years to double knowledge since the beginning of the Common Era until the 18th century. And in the year 2020, knowledge will be doubled every 75 days. The ability then to focus on fundamentals, to have assessment capabilities, to see how the field is in permanent evolution is very important and requires a sustained effort. That's why, as in the past, we would go to conference to bring merchandises and to see who was selling what. Now, the academic endeavors require in a constant fashion this way of exchanging news and stories and see what we can do better and adapt to an ever-changing reality. We can think of many examples to continue to draw on this issue. drawn from our own experience as to the importance of how language is used to frame issues, to advise clients, or find a solution. The choice of language will sometimes determine virtually everything about an issue, from how it is perceived to how it is solved. Language is crucial, essential. The German philosopher Heidegger said once that language is the house of being. Its importance goes beyond the issues of the use and how we put it to use, but it's related to the definition of who we are, the essential and existential definitions of being. In my own field of human rights, I see constantly, of course, as in every other field, the importance of language. As again there, which narrative will prevail, will capture the imagination of the decision makers and predetermine a result. Key concepts, for example, such as torture. I'm going this Saturday with six students of this law school to a committee against torture. I am a member of that committee of the United Nations. If we see there, for example, the problems of definition are crucial. And the different narratives related to these problems of definition predetermine the issue. Do we include emotional aspects or only physical aspects of torture? What's the scope of the physical pressure that could be utilized against human beings, and so forth and so on. But I would say the place, the domain where we decide the issues is in the domain of language, and that really predetermines the decision-making of the supervisory organs. Few appreciate the critical role of language in shaping the law than Professor Teresa Godwin-Feltz, who joined our faculty in the year 2006 as the director of our legal rhetoric program. Teresa's contributions to that program have been immense. She has great knowledge, expertise, enthusiasm, and commitment to the program and to our law school community. She has published widely in the area of language and the law, is a member of the Association of Legal Writing Directors, and serves on the editorial board of the Journal of the Association of Legal Writing Directors. We're very proud to have her with the colleagues in legal writing as active members of our community. And Teresa, I invite you to the podium. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Claudio. Can you all hear me? Okay. This conference, How Legal Rhetoric Shapes the Law, is an occasion for us to celebrate several things. First, it's our initiatory conference here under my directorship of the Legal Rhetoric Program at Washington College of Law. As many of you know, I've run a number of conferences, but it's a new adventure running one in a new school. And this is the first one, of many, I hope, since that we say around here that Claudio Grossman has never seen a conference he doesn't like and won't fund. So we are hoping that we are able to do many conferences in the future. But we want to celebrate today. And first, we want to celebrate our own legal rhetoric program at Washington College of Law. We are the sixth largest law school in the country, with a 1L class this year of over 500 students, including 100 in the evening division. That size alone presents an interesting, shall I say, challenge for a writing program. We are currently staffed with a director, 4 full-time instructors, 26 adjunct instructors, and nearly 50 dean's fellows. So I always say I'm in charge of a cast of thousands, and librarians as well contribute to the teaching and work in the program. So it is indeed almost a cast of thousands, and an interesting challenge for those of us who are professionals in the legal writing community to think about how we can run good programs in schools of this size and this complexity. And I have found it very exciting, and actually fun is a word I've been using frequently, to be here. I feel honored to be among my colleagues at Washington College of Law. Second, we want to celebrate the excellent substantive scholarship that is going on in the legal writing community and about legal language. There is wonderful work that has developed over the last couple of decades. And as many in this room know, the legal writing community, the profession of legal writing, has grown and become sophisticated and changed immensely in the past few decades. And one of the things that has characterized that growth and development is the emergence of a body of scholarship about legal writing and about law and language. And there are many people in this room who have contributed to that. On the panels today, we have some, certainly not all, of these scholars. Some, like my colleagues Bob Dinnerstein and Anne Shalick, bring a sophisticated understanding of language theory to other areas of law. And others, like many panelists who identify as legal writing scholars, their work explores fascinating and important substantive areas that further our understanding of law as language. What we teach in legal writing, and I've said this often, it's become my refrain, is often not regarded as seriously as it should be. Oh yes, you know, there's the cliche that we teach the most important course in the law school, but that's really about the students will be writing when they go out in jobs, and it's important that they write well. And that's true, and that is one of the importances of the of what we teach. But the importance of teaching about the use and awareness of language far exceeds skills training. Law is language. Language itself can be violence. It can foment violence, as we have recently tragically seen in places like Rwanda. So also, it can encourage peacemaking. It can, in fact, be peacemaking. Language, its stories, its metaphors and archetypes, tells us who we are and should be as legal actors. It tells us also how we should think about the law. Law, law is, they say, a seamless web, a structure, a body, a magic mirror. It has a hand. It has eyes. We have mirrors of justice, or is it scales of justice? Freedom is a set of barriers. We speak of and act on walls of separation, penumbras, fixed stars, zones of twilight, chains of title, black letter rules, dams and dikes. We have poison pills, blue skies, and sunshine. I could go on, and it would be great fun to do so. But I think the point is made. Language, legal rhetoric, shapes, makes, furthers, changes, and challenges the law. Third, it is fitting to use this occasion, and this will come as a surprise to Jim White, but I'd like to use this occasion to celebrate the work of James Boyd White, who has pioneered much of the thinking about law and language. I'm not going to even read through his biography or bibliography. We all can probably recite it. He is a giant in this area. What I would like to do is just say a few things that he has said in his books, and I've had great fun this week looking into some of his books again. In The Legal Imagination, which is, of course, the first important book that many say established the field of law and literature, established the area of thinking seriously about law and language, he wrote that to ask how to read and write well is to ask practically everything. And indeed, a legal education might be defined by saying that one learns to read and write the professional language of the law. In Justice as Translation, and this is a bit of a paraphrase, he says, law is a branch of rhetoric, the art of persuasion and the art of deliberation. Law as rhetoric is also constitutive. Law constitutes a world of meaning and action, actors and speakers. The beginning of wisdom is to be aware of the language, is to be as aware of the language we use as we are aware of the world in which we use it. In When Words Lose Their Meaning, he said that one of the book's objects is to set forth a conception of law as an art essentially literary and rhetorical in nature, a way of establishing meaning and constituting community in language. Beyond setting this kind of example of the depth of scholarship that's possible about law and language, Jim White has mentored and supported many of us in this room and elsewhere. I am privileged to count him as a mentor and a friend, and he is, above all, a good man. Jim White.
Thank you, Terry, for those more than kind words. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I thank you for having me. You should all have a handout. Do you all have a handout? Okay. You don't have a handout. Is there a handout? It's not too important, except that it's valuable to have a handout when someone's talking, because it gives you something to read when you get bored. The other question is whether you can hear me, and if you can't hear me, up. Okay, I'll do it like this. A little better? No, not better. A little better? That's better. Okay, there's no point in my doing this if I can't be heard, right? Okay, what my title today is When Language Meets the Mind, Three Questions. And I want to talk about a certain moment that lies at the center of imaginative life and expression, whether in the law, literature, or ordinary life, namely the moment when language meets the mind. My hope is to sketch out here a way of thinking about both law and literature and other things as well. You could consider it an essay in rhetorical, legal, cultural, literary analysis of a kind that I hope can be brought to lots of texts, and I hope what I say may be of some value to you both in this conference and in your work beyond this. But what I'm doing is not so much an introduction to future work as retrospective in character, an effort to generalize from work I have done on language and meaning over the past several decades. The generalization takes the form not of a set of propositions, but of three questions, questions I hope you'll be able to use in your own thinking. I want to begin with a sort of excursus on a slightly different subject. Begin by invoking the first item on your packet, which is an epigraph from the French philosopher Simone Weil. In one English translation, it is this: only he who knows the empire of force and how not to respect it is capable of love and justice. This sentence comes from Weil's famous essay on the Iliad, where she reads that great poem as simultaneously defining and deeply opposing the human desire to dominate and enslave and destroy other human beings. For Homer wrote about, and in one sense celebrated, an heroic world of which the chief value was military prowess. But he also opposed this culture by repeatedly showing the reader what no one in the poem could ever see, namely the full humanity of the people on both sides of the war, the full humanity of Greek and Trojan. In the Iliad, as elsewhere, what she calls the empire of force is partly a matter of physical violence, of course. But behind the physical violence, as Weil sees, is the mentality that makes it possible. For organized evil action always depends upon forms of thought and speech, ideologies, habits of thinking, forms of language, ways of imagining the world that deny or trivialize the reality of other human beings. Weil is telling us that whenever we speak or think or write, as people or as lawyers or as law students, we too should ask ourselves whether we understand the empire of force at work in our lives, in our languages, in our own minds, and whether we know how not to respect it. This is an issue, that is, not only for the people of Homer's Iliad and for Homer himself, but for all of us. Certainly, for example, in the way we think and talk about armed conflict and those who are killed and tortured, but also in the way in which we think about divisions within our own country based on race or religion, for example. And beyond that, when we talk about what seem to be neutral matters, but unwittingly do so in a language that demeans other people or denies the richness and value of human life, a language of commercial advertising, for example, or party politics or political propaganda, we may, without knowing it at all, be serving the empire of force in what we say and do. And to the extent that is so, if they is correct, as I think she is, we shall be incapable of love and justice. Perhaps the last things we would want to be able, we would want to say about ourselves. So it's from the point of view defined by Vey's sentence, then, that I wish to speak about what happens when language meets the mind. I shall do this by identifying three questions that I believe one can ask of any human utterance in literature, law, or the rest of life. My questions are simple ones, but in my experience, fruitful, indeed essential to responsible thought and expression in any domain of life. A bold claim, which I'll repeat at the end. And the fact that they are simple does not mean that they're not the product of sustained thought. I've been working on them my whole professional life. The first question concerns language itself, regarded not simply as a code, but as the embodiment and carrier of culture. One can always ask, with respect to any language act, whatever, in a sense, the most obvious question, what is the language, the dialect, the special way of speaking that this writer is using, or that I am called upon to use? How does this language work as a set of social and cultural practices, as a system of meaning? Now, this is an external, descriptive, analytic question about something in the world outside of the self, something called the language. Consider, for example, the following. The highly defined art language in which Homer composed the Iliad and the Odyssey. This was a language developed over centuries for the specific purpose of making a certain kind of poetry, poetry which told stories about the heroic past. For the epic poet, this language was mandatory. If you wished to be a poet of this kind, you had to speak this language. It had clear formal requirements of diction, meter, syntax, and so on, and equally deep substantive commitments, for it was designed to represent and celebrate the martial and heroic culture, the world of heroes and gods, that it brought into imaginary existence. Or think of the ordinary Greek of Plato's Athens, which shaped the habits and thoughts of thought and speech with which he grew up. For him, the values and motives expressed in this language were deeply flawed, yet they were also, at the same time, materials of his own thought. This presented him with a question that drives much of his philosophy. How could he possibly think critically about the only language and culture that he knew? Or, to shift worlds completely, we might think about the 19th century American language of poetry, that confronted a woman who, like Emily Dickinson, wished to be a poet in that world. This language worked by a highly specific and limiting set of mandatory conventions with which any poet of the time would have to come to terms, and which, as we shall see, Dickinson was determined to resist. Or we might think of modern law, whether in our country or in Europe or elsewhere in the world. For law always establishes a set of things one can say and a way of saying them. It is, too, in a powerful sense, mandatory. If you are to function as a lawyer, you must speak this language, these ways. If you know the language of the law, you can say and do important things that other people cannot. But all you're saying and doing is subject to the most specific and powerful limitations and prohibitions. As a lawyer, an essential part of your experience, in fact, is a kind of frustration at not being able to say or do everything you wish in the language of the law. Now, each of these languages can be described and analyzed, both in formal terms, diction, syntax, grammar, and so on, and as a cultural system, a system of substantive meaning. One can ask, for example, how it represents the world of nature. What does water mean here, or vegetative life, or the sun, or the mountain? How does it represent and constitute the social world? Who are the actors here? What expectations govern their lives? What relations are assumed to exist among them? What forms of thought does this language validate and make possible? What counts as reason in this world? And how are human motives and values defined? As soon as it comes to be understood, the language can also be criticized by exploring its own contradictions, by comparison with other cultures, and by the invocation of one's own experiences of life. But the first question, what is this language, calls for then is a kind of cultural analysis and criticism. Now that's to look at language from the outside. When we look at it from the inside, as someone who must speak or write it, or when we examine the expression of somebody else using the language in a particular context, quite another kind of question presents itself. What is the relationship between this language and the mind using it? What should it be? What happens when this mind meets this language? Now, this question actually has two forms, which I could put this way. What do I do to the language? And what does the language do to me? And I shall begin with the second and perhaps more surprising form of the question. The idea at work here is that the languages and practices we learn from our culture embed themselves in our minds, create within us without our quite knowing it certain ways of imagining the world, including both other people and ourselves, certain ways of defining value, certain ways of conceiving of the nature of reason. When we learn the languages of our culture, we learn a set of habits of mind and attention that mark our minds. This is, in fact, what an education is. As doctors, lawyers, football scouts, fishing guides, pilots, we learn modes of thought and expression that change who we are. To some extent, we become the languages we speak. That's an essential part of an education. So we can always ask ourselves, what does this language do to me? And we can ask the same question of others as well, of Plato, for example, or Emily Dickinson. Now, there's a wonderful passage on this subject from Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi, which is the first item in your packet and way too long to read. Here, Twain tells us, but you can take it, you can read it while I'm talking. Here, Twain tells us that as a passenger, before he knew how to be a pilot, he saw the river with the romantic eyes of a person on a steamboat, saw the river as a mighty and beautiful force of nature. But when he was trained as a pilot, he came to see it very differently, as full of signs to the riverman, telling him, here's a sandbar, there's a tree about to fall into the river, and so on. The river became a wonderful book, he tells us, but learning to read it destroyed the vision he earlier had of the scene. He no longer saw the world the same way. Well, this passage presents a real question for the lawyer or doctor or politician or any trained or educated person. What do our educations cost us? To what extent do our minds become colonized, taken over by the languages of the profession we learn? This can and should be a question for students of law in particular. What happens to your capacity to think about justice in a fresh and real way, for example, or about other people as people entitled to respect and compassion, and not just as elements in a paradigmatic legal story? For a much more poignant and troubling example, think of what it does to every person in America to grow up with the American language of race. It marks every mind and imagination. Imagine, for example, what it would have been like to be a white child growing up, the white child of a slave owner growing up in pre-war Mississippi. The world of beastly racial oppression would seem a part of nature, just the way things are. And the same would have been true for the black child growing up as a slave. In different ways, the words of race would be facts of their minds and hearts. We no longer have slavery, but we do have race, and it affects us all. How race works on the mind is the subject of Mark Twain's greatest book, Huckleberry Finn. You remember, of course, that Huck and Jim, the runaway slave, have escaped down the river where they lead a life of shared adventure, and that Jim proves himself to be Huck's friend, his only real friend, and his teacher. And at the crisis of the story, Huck sees the men in boats hunting runaway slaves and, overcome by what he calls his conscience, decides to do the right thing and turn Jim in. But he finds he cannot do it. And instead, with enormously skillful lies, he deflects their attention from the raft he shares with Jim by planting in their minds the idea that his family on the raft suffer from smallpox. When the men have left, Huck reflects on his experience in the following famous terms. everybody's favorite passage in American literature. They went off, and I got bad, got aboard the raft feeling bad and low because I know very well I'd done wrong, and I see it weren't no use for me to try to do right. A body don't get started right when he's little, ain't got no show. When the pinch comes, there ain't nothing to back him up and keep it to his work, so he gets beat. Then I thought a minute and says to myself, hold on, suppose you'd have done right and give Jim up. Would you feel better than what you do now? No, says I, I'd feel bad. I feel just the same way I do now. Well, then, says I, what's the use you learning to do right when it's troublesome to do right and ain't no trouble to do wrong and the wages is just the same? I was stuck. I couldn't answer that, so I reckoned I wouldn't bother no more about it, but after this, do whichever come handiest at the time. Well, this passage presents two distinct puzzles. One of them, why is it that Huck cannot say what you and I would say about the slave hunters, about slavery, about his own conduct in protecting Jim? For we can see perfectly plainly that Jim is his best friend, his only friend, that Huck and Jim love and respect each other, that slavery and racism are obviously radical evils, a fundamental denial of humanity, and that Huck's own conduct was admirable and courageous and skilled. Why can Huck not see and say these things? Why, indeed, can he not even imagine them? Now, the answer is, in a sense, obvious. He's been trained by his culture not to see, let alone to say such truths. His performed incapacity is, in fact, a representation of the force of culture and language on the mind. The language of race and slavery and property work on his mind to make what is perfectly obvious to us simply unthinkable and unsayable to him, despite his own contrary experience. The second puzzle is the opposite, suggested by the fact that Huck, when pressed, does not, in fact, do the right thing for a white boy in his world. He doesn't turn Jim into the slave hunters. How is it that he's able to make this refusal to resist the mandate of his culture, to achieve, in fact, the moral and intellectual confusion that he achieves here? For this confusion is an achievement. Tom Sawyer, the future lawyer or banker, would never have attained it. At the moment, I do not have the time to explain how this happens. In a sense, it's the point of the novel to do that. But I can say that this is partly the result of Huck's marginal status, which gives him a perspective from which to see the dominant culture, partly the result of his habit of reflecting on his experience, trying to make sense of what makes no sense, partly the result of what Jim offers him on the raft, a kind of care and attention and recognition he has never known. Now, for our purposes, the point of this is that this passage defines Huck's relation with the language of race and slavery in a highly complex way. We can see that it has indeed done something to him. It marks his mind and feeling to the core. But he can do something to it as well, for he finds he can resist it in his conduct. But this resistance is incomplete because he cannot find a way to express adequately the truth of his own experience. He cannot rewrite his language except into productive confusion. So one form of the question about the relation of the mind to language is this: what's it do to me, to my mind? The second form is, what do I do to it or with it? How can I resist it or work with it or transform it? This is a question of art, and it can be asked not only of ourselves, but of other speakers and writers, including characters in fictional compositions. For another example, about which I'll be very brief, let us turn to Plato. Plato lived in a world defined by a language of value and motive, the ordinary Greek of his day, that he thought deeply wrong. And the story of his writing is in large part the story of his attempt to come to terms with that language, to criticize it, and to rewrite it. Obviously, this Greek was a complex language, reflecting a complex culture, but to oversimplify, you could say that its central terms of value were agathos and kalos, which mean good and noble, and their opposites, kakos and aiskros, which mean bad and shameful. These words not only had a moral signification, as they do with us, but they also reflected an ethics of prestige and success. The positive terms referred to a person, a male, who was wealthy, successful, handsome, powerful, dominant in every way. Perhaps the Hispanic term macho might capture some sense of it. The negative terms refer to the opposite, those who are ugly, poor, weak, contemptible. In this language, you could not be poor or weak or ugly and good. This was Plato's only language. Yet in a deep way, it made no sense to him, or imperfect sense, or somehow the wrong kind of sense. He had an intuition that this was not the right way to think. Yet he had no way to say it, for he had no place outside of his language from which to stand and see it and criticize it. From his awareness of this problem arose his invention of the philosophic dialogue, an intellectual and social form that constituted a way of putting his language into explicit question. As you'll remember, what happens typically in one of his dialogues is that someone speaking a version of ordinary Greek is brought into conversation with Socrates and shown by stages that the formulations upon which he's built his life, do not make sense and are no longer sayable by him. He's also likely to be said things that he now discovers to be true, but which themselves make no sense in the larger culture. He is brought to utter impossible formulations. Now, something like that relationship between Socrates and his interlocutor is created by Plato in his relationship to the reader. We too find our language undone, taken apart, lying in pieces at our feet. Plato's relation to his language is that of user, critic, destroyer, remaker. For another example of a mind working on and with its language, transforming it, let me turn to Emily Dickinson. As a young woman, she obviously had an enormous need and desire to express herself as a poet. But she lived in a world in which there were rigid conventions governing poetry in general, and the poetry of women in particular. To be what was called a poetess in this world, one had to write about certain subjects: nature, death, love, and God, and do so in perfectly rhyming, perfectly metrical, perfectly sentimental verse. Dickinson transformed this sentimental and poetic language. She did use the regular hymn tune metrical structure she inherited, but with much more variation than was allowed. She did use rhyme, but marked heavily with off rhymes. And she did regular violence to diction and grammar, using verbs as nouns, nouns as verbs, and just devising wholly other new locutions. And above all, she was utterly unsentimental, anti-sentimental, in fact. For her, poetry was a way of putting the commitments of her culture into question, a little like Plato's dialogues, in fact, or Homer's Iliad. Consider, for example, the following poem in your packet, written in the regular rhythms of a hymn tune and having as its subject death, one of the retired topics. Yet it is brutally anti-sentimental. I like the look of agony. I like a look of agony because I know it's true. Men do not sham convulsion or simulate a throw. The eyes glaze once, and that is death. Impossible to feign the beads upon the forehead by homely anguish strung. The first line begins, I like, as though what will follow will be something like the songs of spring or the mellow mists of fall, or perhaps the beauty of a caring heart. It ends, a look of agony, in a macabre, even ghoulish turn. What could lead a person to like such a thing as another person's suffering? She tells us, because it's true. In other words, this is the expression of a person who is so surrounded by such falsity and has been all her life that she turns with eagerness to something she knows to be true, even if it's hideous. Not a sentimental view of childhood, nor of death either. Now, it's worth saying that Dickinson paid an enormous practical price for her innovations. She was unpublished during her lifetime, except for a handful of poems which had been heavily rewritten by an uncomprehending editor. It was really not until the 1950s and 60s that even the most sophisticated and intelligent part of the American literary public was prepared to read her poems as she wrote them. The culture she resisted and transformed in her poems had a force she could not overcome. Now, I hope what you can see, I hope you can see something of what I mean then when I say that we can ask the question, what is the relationship to our language in two ways? What's it do to us, or what do we do with it? On the one hand, am I the instrument of the language, its creature, simply printing out its ways of thinking and its values? Or can I subject it to some kind of control, put it to my purposes, criticize it, transform it, make it say or do something different? This is what Twain, Dickinson, and Plato all do, wonderfully, yet, of course, incompletely. Now, here, it might be useful to think about the experience of the law student, those we once were and those we teach. Who do I become in speaking this language is a real topic for an intelligent person becoming a lawyer. Do I become a caricatured version of a desiccated legal analyst? Suppose I always sounded like a lawyer. Or can I somehow find a way to control, to transform this language that now inhabits my mind, which I'm inviting into my mind? One can see how hard this is for the student or young lawyer. There is no place to stand securely outside the law from which you can examine it and its effect on you. You must think about it from the inside at exactly the same time it's shaping you. The same thing, of course, is true for the Greek of Plato and the racial language of America and our languages of morals, economics, and politics as well. The task, an essentially literary one, is to find a way to understand and criticize one's resources of meaning, to use them for one's own purposes, to use them to form purposes in the first place, at the same time they're shaping one's own mind and habits of attention. How are we to judge our own efforts and those of other people? There's no language outside language in which to think about better and worse, no place outside culture, outside the self that the culture has done so much to form. All attempts to think about language replicate the problem inherent in any use of language, for all thought about such questions must proceed in particular languages, each of which normalizes itself in our minds, even if it is in fact deeply evil, crudely limiting, or just a string of cliches and slogans. In my view, there can be no theoretical or conceptual answer to such a problem. What is called for is a kind of art. Each person has to make her own way with the aid of such examples of excellence as she can find. Answers, that is, lie not in theories or programmatic statements, but in our own performances and what we can learn from the performances of others. The work of judgment must proceed as artistic and literary criticism normally does, by the study of particulars, by the focused attention of the whole mind upon what's happening and upon one's response to it. Here as elsewhere, it's one's task to form one's mind and self through thoughtful experiment and experience. So if the first question, what is this language, invites a kind of cultural analysis and criticism, the second, what's my relation to it, invites a kind of artistic analysis and criticism. I want now to identify another kind of question. It is this. What relationship do I establish not with the language I use, but with my reader or audience or with those about whom I speak? This is to focus on what I shall call the ethical dimension of speech, and it calls for a form of ethical criticism. In the sense in which I'm using the term, all language use is ethical. Not ethical in the normative sense, as morally good rather than bad, but in an analytic sense. Speech is always a form of social action, and as such always has ethical content, which can be either good or bad. For in any expression, I define myself a certain way, you a certain way, and establish a presumptive relation between us. I act with you or upon you. With these identities and relations and actions can all be thought about and criticized in ethical and even political terms. We all know this from our own experience of ordinary life, because we all know what it's like to be patronized, talked down to, manipulated, abused, flattered, cajoled, or bullied by someone in his speech or writing. And we know, on the other hand, what it means to be treated with dignity, spoken to as an intelligent and decent person, and so on. Now, the speech of the lawyer is ethical in a special way, for its task is to define and redefine the institutions of the law, indeed the institutions of political life. When a lawyer argues to a court or speaks as a judge, one can properly ask, how does he define in his speech himself, the court, the legislature, the Constitution, the constitutional past, the people who are the source of all authority? How does he define the law itself? You can see some obvious possibilities. Is he, in his speech, a reasoning person speaking to reasoning beings? At stake here is the question whether law itself is a domain of reason, and in what sense. Likewise, is he concerned about justice? Does he speak to someone likewise concerned, and in what way? At stake here is the question whether the law itself is a domain of justice, and in what sense. Now, it's an extended example of a political text that can be analyzed as an ethical text in the way in which I mean it. I want to look now at Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural. First, let me define quickly the situation in which he spoke. By 1865, when he gave this address, the country had been involved for over 4 years in a hideous civil war. This war was to kill 750,000 people out of a population of, I think, 30 million. Our nation's only experience of war that can be compared with that of Europe, say, in the 20th century. Lincoln had been elected to a second term by an electorate drawn, naturally enough, only from the Union states. The war was going well for the Union, and victory could be foreseen. What victory would mean was a wholly different matter, and is the subject of his speech. His task was Herculean in its difficulty. He had to find a way to congratulate the Union on its impending victory and to confirm in his supporters the view that the war was worth its dreadful cost. For this to be so, it had to be a war against terrible evil. Yet the people of the White South were now to become part of the country once more, and he had to find a rhetorical place for them too as something other than total villains. And somehow, he had to find as well a way of talking about the now liberated slaves, a way of talking that would recognize the hideous injustice of their brutal exploitation under the system that had been overthrown, but without calling the white Southerners monsters. How could he possibly do all these things? I won't read the first paragraph, which you can do on your own, but just say that it seems to be written in utterly dead and empty prose. Abraham Lincoln is the greatest prose writer our country ever produced, and this is apparently one of the worst paragraphs. In most English courses, students are told to avoid the passive voice whenever possible because it eliminates actors from the scene, and with actors, their personality and their responsibility. Yet Lincoln fills this paragraph with passive verbs. He refers to no actors or entities at all until he gets near the end to the nation, which he quickly defines in terms of our arms, that is to say, the North. His reference to the public and all to whom the progress of the war is satisfactory are likewise plainly meant to mean the North and to exclude the South, who could not possibly think those things. It looks as though this is going to be a Northerner's speech addressed only to Northerners. But notice what happens next. On the occasion corresponding to this 4 years ago, all thoughts were anxiously directed to an impending civil war. All dreaded it, all sought to avert it. While the inaugural address was being delivered from this place, devoted altogether to saving the Union without war, insurgent agents were in the city seeking to destroy it without war, seeking to dissolve the Union and divide effects by negotiation. Both parties deprecated war. But one of them would make war rather than let the nation survive. The other would accept war rather than let it perish, and the war came. In his talk of all thoughts, all people dreading and seeking to avert the war, Lincoln plainly includes the white South. It really was everyone who feared and wanted to avoid the war. But that does not mean that there is not any moral difference between North and South. The North wanted to save the Union without war. The white South, through their insurgent agents, wanted to destroy it without war. We Northerners were loyal citizens. Those Southerners were traitors. Lincoln insists upon the moral distinction between North and South, yet in the last phrase, "and the war came," there is a feeling that both are somehow the victims of a new actor called into existence by their differences, the war itself. Now notice that the moral distinction that Lincoln does articulate between the attitudes of North and South rests on their attitudes towards the Union, not towards slavery, the collective crime that lay in some sense at the root of everything. And in the next, what he next says, he speaks as though slavery is simply not a moral issue. 1/8 of the whole population were colored slaves, not distributed generally over the Union, but localized in the southern part of it. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest, not their own. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. To strengthen, perpetuate, and extend this interest was the object for which the insurgents would rend the Union even by war, while the government claimed no right to do more than to restrict the territorial enlargement of it. Lincoln here sounds as though he's writing a kind of almanac or eighth grade history book or something like that, that erases the moral significance of slavery entirely. Slavery is an interest like timber or mining. Can he mean this? It would be a terrible moral failure. In the next paragraph, he continues his effort to unite the white South and North, apparently at the expense of blacks, by stressing even more strongly the ways in which the main opposing parties were similarly situated. Neither party expected for the war the magnitude or duration which it has already attained. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with or between the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. The strong repetition of neither, both, and each establishes the moral equality of the two sides by insisting that no distinction can really be drawn between them. The last sentence about praying to the same God identifies the sides as similar, but in a new and negative way, both as self-righteous, hubristic, even blasphemous. So far, Lincoln has regarded slavery simply as an institution or fact, not as a wrong. In taking this position, he seems to be including the white South in his audience by conceding this point to them. But in the next sentence, he speaks about slavery in a wholly different way, as a moral wrong of the deepest order. It may seem strange that any men should dare ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from other men's faces. This is a strong and honest condemnation. But then he quickly shifts, building upon the sense of the blasphemous and dangerous implied in the mutual prayers of destruction. Let us judge not, lest we be judged. So where are we? He then goes on to say, the prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to the man by whom the offense cometh. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away, little hymn. Yet if God wills that it continue till all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, till every drop of blood drawn with a lash shall be paid by another drawn with a sword, it was said 3,000 years ago, so it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. What Lincoln is doing in this passage is creating a providential history, defining the entire nation as one actor, as in the Old Testament, the people of Israel is one actor. And like Israel, an actor in a moral and theological universe. Here, human slavery is at last presented as the world historical crime that it is. But North and South are now seen as jointly responsible for it, which was to a large degree certainly true, and jointly suffering for it. He strips from his own supporters the mantle of self-righteous victory. In his little hymn, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray," he speaks for North and South as united, as one people, and as one with those who had suffered this terrible wrong. Likewise, in acknowledging helplessness before the deity and the righteousness of punishment for their collective wrong, he speaks for all, this time including the black victims of slavery as well. This enables him, in his famous last paragraph, finally to speak in a humane way on behalf of the entire nation. His words, "none and all and us, the nation and widow and orphan, ourselves," include white and black, North and South, in a new community imagined into existence in this speech. With malice towards none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wound, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Now, Lincoln's achievement is astonishing in my view, but the fact that he spoke this way did not bring his idealized community into existence. Far from it. Race and tensions between North and South are still stains on our country's life. But he did make it possible for us to live with hopes of better things, for he showed us how to imagine better things, and to do so in a way that made us responsible for our own past and our own share in wrongdoing. So, in this talk, I have proposed that when one thinks about what happens when the language meets the mind, or when someone uses language, three kinds of questions, each pointing the way to further work, naturally suggest themselves. First, what is the language that this speaker, or that I myself, is given by the culture to use? What do I think of it? In Lincoln's case, this is the language of war, of enmity, of victory and defeat, and of self-righteousness. Second, what relation does this speaker establish with this language? What's it do to him? What's he do to it? In Lincoln's case, we can see him transforming the language of war and the genre of the inaugural address before our eyes into something else and far better. Third, what relation does this speaker establish with those others in his speech, those spoken about and those spoken to? What community or polity does he seek to establish? This is the dimension of meaning in Lincoln's address that I've just discussed, in which he imagines North and South, white and black, becoming united in a nation with its own providential history. Each question calls for a different kind of analysis and criticism, the first cultural, the second artistic or literary, the third ethical and political. Now here's the major claim I want to make. Very short, but here's the major claim. I said it at the beginning and said I'd come back to it. It's a little tendentious, but I mean it seriously. I think that these three questions are not mere language questions, and as such, secondary or technical, but the first questions of intellectual life, present in constantly in every enterprise of thought. They are not the only questions we can ask, but I think they are the first questions, and they ought never be left behind as if they've been answered or as if they could be what the social scientists call bracketed. Now, not all questions are reducible to questions of language, of course, but questions of language are present and essential in every activity of human thought. Thus, all work in philosophy, literature, history, law, economics, sociology, science, all work in our actual political and social lives ought to be concerned not only with the explicit subject of the discourse, the causes of revolution, the meaning of Shakespeare's sonnets, the nature of criminal responsibility, the character of social wealth, the structure of certain institutions, the evolution of bird songs, the propriety of a proposal for public health care or plan to go to war, but not only with those, but also with the language in which it's carried on, the culture of which it's a part, the way in which that language and culture acts on our minds and the minds of others, the way in which it can be resisted and transformed, and the selves and communities and institutions, the possibilities for individual and collective life that can be created in this language, in this culture, and by what art. Of course, this is a council of perfection which can never be fully attained, but I think these questions should be alive for us in all of our fields as the foundation of mature intellectual life, and above all, in law. Now, to explain why I think this so strongly, let me ask you to think once more about the various languages I've talked about. The American language of race and slavery, the language of the Homeric epic, the moral language of Plato's Athens, the sentimentalizing language of American women's poetry, and the language of war in the context of the American Civil War. Each of these, in a different way, represents what Simone Weil calls the empire of force. For each is a way of dehumanizing others or oneself, a way of reducing or denying the full possibilities of human experience. Each of the writers and speakers I've discussed, Homer, Plato, Dickinson, Twain, and Lincoln, was partly formed by the discourse he was given to speak, which was in a sense embedded in his or her mind. Each of them also found a way to put that language into question, to make it the object of criticism and to transform it in a way that showed that he or she did not respect the empire of force. More than that, each of them, in doing this, showed us how we might do likewise. Showed us, that is, how we might understand the empire of force at work in our minds and learn how not to respect it. And in doing these things, how to come closer to the goal of every decent human life, which is to be capable of love and justice. Thank you.
We have plenty of time for questions, and I would certainly hope that we can engage Jim in some conversation about his ideas. So, questions from anyone?
Right.
To be able to go beyond the inherited.
I'm not sure I can hear you on the other side. Did you guys hear the question on the other side of the room? Okay.
I'm walking away from you, not because I'm turning your back. I'll respond to that. Well, suppose you take the light and come to where it fits. And compare it to Tom Sawyer. Tom Sawyer is totally affected by his culture. He just, has no reason. It's just a fact. He's going to come back to Hannibal and he's going to be a lawyer or a banker. He doesn't know what he's going to do. And he's going to be a decent guy. He's going to go to church and he's elected to Congress. But he says that the culture is going to be running through. So how the public really gets to know that? One thing. That he had the advantage of being an artist. And everybody can get that in our world, but a lot of people don't know what to do with art. So you have the experience of not quite getting in, it's great, it's very, very here and very older, that guy is going to be and you feel like it's not his, but for the realist. And his response to that, and he's not given an alternative culture, and it wasn't his advantage, so he was trying to do the second point. This thing, only recognize you,
Just considering trying to synthesize the way Westminster is true, all Yeah. That's great. There's a ton of stuff there. I can begin with the simplest part, which is there's something about the title, which is wrong. That language means a lot. It sounds as though there's this pristine thing of applying to the language. And that isn't, well, I hope I make that clear later. That isn't my view. But I know that I don't know the title from that, but it's certainly true. That the language is part of getting in the human development being, at least from birth. And you're shaped by the ways of conversing you have with other people, which you learn from other people, and the process of modifying is present from the very beginning. That is to say, the model of sort of mindless language is just repetition. Yes, it's also not really the truth is that people modify all the time. And they still be speaking cliches, but they modify because they modify the cliche. Another one had an experiment, linguistic term, had an experiment which was done by veterans, so about the nature of the sentence, which involved the following. He said, I want you to write a sentence about what happens between when I say now and when I say stop. So he had a rhythm, and then he walks to his table, sits down, and then he comes to stop. They all get a sentence, they all got the sentences. But one of the really interesting things, he's done this hundreds of times, he says, as far as he knows, he's never, ever had something simple as that, but always chasing, then the question is, there's something within. Now that's actually potentially liberating. And it also is a fact which can many more acutely sense of responsibility. Where you say, actually, I am making choices and values every single second, all the time, for which I'm responsible. And I'm in a situation where people expect a certain kind of thought from the law professor or from the judge or from the academy or something like this. But how can I do this well or bad? And we, in fact, this is a part of doing this. It's a general matter. It's a part of all kinds of experience. So, you know, we all this time to get along, various social circumstances, and achieve our objectives and think that they are, and just think of the academy as an example. How do you talk to a taxi cab driver? And who do you want to be in talking to a taxi cab driver? You can be a jerk, you can be a jerk cue, you can be a decent person, you can be patronizing, all those things are present in this very small. Or can you find a way to be a general name over the kinds of economic disparities that exist between you and the target or something like that? Or the racial disparities, can you find a way to be a decent? Well, I just applied something really hard at which we can all say, well, I don't think we can succeed. The language is time that this skills are back to the information. I don't view things about this, but I think of this question. And the way this whole problem comes from the fact that my mind is focused, that is full of bad examples and slogans and cliches. No ways of thinking, things I've invented myself. And the question is how to think about those controls in some way. One of the advantages of writing is you have to do it slow motion, so you have to sign the book, sign the chair there, this one's up there, what am I doing? And reading is very helpful because you have to see people, you can do it slow motion, you watch people really change.
each other around the corner.
This is a difficult
room. As law is seen by many more as a business now, no different than an auto mechanic or a pharmacist with a certain level of ethics, but a certain demand for the bottom line. We're really concerned with the language and everything that that lawyers are concerned with it when from the time the person walks in the door to the time they leave is paying bills, making money. How does that heighten the need for seeing law as language, and how does it heighten the challenge that we as educators face?
I don't really know firsthand much about what's happened to modern law, but I know quite a lot about secondhand. And what you described is what I hear over and over and over all that law has become a business. It makes the object just to make money, and this affects the way lawyers interact with each other, interact with the way they relate to their clients. And I see sort of as the language matter, I see that not necessarily the heart of it, but somewhere near, I see a phrase like legal services. And so what a lawyer does is legal services for our business to accommodate and make it basically fungible. Or fungible maybe rent some, loans, very famous crimes, choices, or something like that. But the same thing is the same thing with us. I don't think of my doctors offering me legal services. I call too often. They are offering me legal services. They have to come in, you have basically fungible component of the system. They do a certain set of things with you. They have the algorithm, try the algorithm, patch in the back and say, right, or whatever it doesn't say. And we'll take three bills or take a test and see what the practice says. But so the same problem actually exists in the medical practice. The doctors are under enormous pressure to behave as bad lawyers. And lawyers are under enormous pressure. So I think that all of you are in very good positions to do as much as can be done. Is to help your students develop as efficiently independent minds so that they don't just leap into the maw of an empire of force and ask to be chewed up, which so many of them do, and from least to a high, and then very often. By way of my own personal way of dealing with this, you know, constantly, is to talk about something that say you have a is that thinking about their professional work, they should ask themselves, do they want to work? What do they want to do? If they have a hard time thinking this, they ought to try and go back in their minds before they go to law school and say, why did I go to law school in the first place? Ask yourself what kind of life you would like to lead yourself, not what you think the school wants you to lead. What kind of life would you like to lead yourself? Where do you like to lead? And then see if you can find a way to approximate that. Instead of just going down to the placement office and standing in line, you enter your mind these big factories are the only people who come to this particular school, maybe you can also be able to collect people for whatever it is. And what I actually think is true, kids in our school, is that there are lots who are a very good sense of socially conservative responsibility. People who want to be a citizen, a family, a play role in the community, and they want to be in school for a year, on city council, they want to have time for the test, they want to have a reasonable and decent kind of existence. Of course, they want to be able to write. But they don't have the kind of staggering amount of big things. And for them, there are options in smaller terms of business and
match for the place they'd like to pass. They can come back with a Michigan grad, and there's grads everywhere. They want to get them to try to be a mentor, look and say, what's practice like here in Spokane? That's really
I was just going to comment that I think it's rather odd that we don't spend more time in law school counseling students about what they want to do with their lives. Because my experience in a big firm, and I've been a partner in two of them, is that they're horrid places to spend a life. They are places where anybody who has any real intellectual curiosity outside the law really is not going to get ahead. And my conclusions were that if you're really going to get ahead in one of those firms, it's almost essential, if you're not lucky, that you be a psychopath or a sociopath, quite seriously. And it seems to me that given the importance of the concept that you've mentioned, the way we ought to be approaching it, that we need to do a whole lot more counseling. On the other hand, if we do that, we may tell a lot of students, and I think it's one of the things that cuts against it, is that in many respects the practice of law today may not be all that enjoyable. And so I think there's kind of a cut. But it's odd that our best students all want, it seems, in general, to go toward the kind of life that I think is absolutely despicable.
Public interest opportunities to our students. But what we don't recognize is this great middle range of law practice that's represented by people in small towns, small cities, sometimes big cities, and the like. Sometimes boutiques, sometimes they do very, very well financially among other things. And sometimes they do. But it would be nice to have people come out of the law school from the practicing law. Here's what I really want to talk about. I'm a big clerk, this is what I like. I'm a medium clerk, this is what I like. I'm a solo practitioner in Jackson, just commissioned. I'm not sure if you can do it. But she should be slung on. But I don't mean to by shrugging my shoulders. I'm not shrugging my shoulders.
I wonder if you've given any thought to the new generation of law students and perhaps the extra layer of embedded bad stuff they have that we never had due to the way they've been stable with technology, et cetera, and if that in any way can affect them, what you're thinking, proposing.
Thank you. kind of resistance.